important. Diversity, diversity, diversity.
Here to have caused confusion.
Oh, precious boy.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Hello, where am I? Why aren't I there? Well, there I am. There I am. Hello, everyone. All right. Well, today we're going to be talking about why don't we change the avatar? What about this one? What about this one? I like this one. Let's go with this one. All of the news in the past couple of days has been about the big peace summit that has taken place in Egypt. And you lot will be grateful to know that because this is latest news, because this has only just happened, it is even ahead of LBC and Talk TV's uploads. So there's not going to be any LBC or Talk TV or Campbell and Stewart this week, a week off from all of that. We're going to be talking about whether Trump has finally done it. Has he brought peace to the Middle East? A lot of takes during the round, of course. A lot of people are skeptical for obvious reasons that the Israelis can't be trusted under any circumstances, and those takes are valid. A lot of the kind of liberal media, I noticed James O'Brien, who I've been catching little bits of when I've been driving places. My radio's still stuck on LBC. He actually went on a bizarre rant against Henry VIII. a complete straw man rant against Henry VIII when I heard him. But James O'Brien's take is that actually all of this is designed to try to get Netanyahu re-elected within Israel. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But apparently Netanyahu has a re-election around the corner. I have the view, actually, that initially I thought this was being set up to fail. But then, as I saw that the Dark Lord was kind of seriously involved, and as I saw that it looked like he was maneuvering all of the different parts into place, I actually think that it may hold for a while, but the absolutely pivotal thing will be, whether Blair is directly involved or not. If he's there on the ground, it will succeed. If somehow they remotely, like the Israelis or the other side, get rid of Blair, it will fail. That's basically my call. So I see him as the pivotal piece. Just as people are trickling in, I'll remind people, promo code Shredder gets 25% off all courses. About 10 days left on promo code Shredder. So you've still got some time to pick up your courses. I'll play the ad, and then when I come back, we will talk about all of this. There's so many little, very interesting interactions between world leaders and things like that to watch. It's promo code Shredder. World-class education denied to you by school, denied to you by woke university. Well, no more. Pick up your course today. 25% off all courses with promo code Shredder. That's Shredder. Buy it now. All right. Foolishly, I have forgotten my lighter. I've left it at home. So I'm stuck with matches here in El Loggio. And it's been... I don't like using matches. I like my jet lighter. But I am smoking a Juan Lopez No. 1. Much underrated cigar. let us get going. So there are lots and lots of clips I want to go through. One of the things is that this whole thing has given us is possibly the most boomer thing I have ever seen, which is the United States ambassador to Israel decided to, I mean, okay, whatever level of boomer you have ever experienced, okay, and we've all seen boomers our whole lives, we've all experienced peak. I think we may have reached peak boomer with this. Let's have a little watch.
Hashem's holy words begin anew. We all have come to help Hatzalah.
There's Captive Dreamer in the front row, moshing his little brains out. This is what I voted for. Oh, yeah.
And we want to help it thrive. Based right here in God's holy city. Throughout this land, it's saving lives. Sweet home, Yerushalayim.
Yeah!
Where God's words ring so true. Sweet home, Yerushalayim. Lord, I'm coming home to you.
It's not AI. This is real. This is actually the American ambassador to Israel doing boomer. I don't know what even Christian rock, Jewish rock, I don't know what you call it, doing this.
Well, friends and friends don't think it's Jewish. The United Nations call us crooks. But Donald Trump claims it's all Israel. Just as it says in all the holy books.
What?
Yeah.
My gosh. All of the front row, Bronze Age pervert with a candle, the Red Scare girls boogieing down. This is what it was all for. All those podcasts, all those hours of streaming. They're all there. Fucking loving it. Every single second of it. Oh, man. Right. Let's see what else. Let's see what else there is. So a lot of the attention by various, in fact, not just the sloppy lists, the mainstream media too, have been focused on various interactions that Trump has been having with world leaders. Before we get to it, we should probably play the actual signing of the document. Have I got that? There's the actual signing of the document. Do I have it? Let me see if I can find the signing of the document. Hold on. Where's the historic 3,000 years of peace document? Oh, here we are. Here we are. I got it right. So let's get the signing of this. I mean, this was, if nothing else, pure theater, right? Of the most theatrical kind. And you know, if it's entertainment you want. We've got it here. Let's have a little watch of this. Is this it? Okay.
We have weapons that nobody's ever dreamt of. I only hope we never have to use them. I rebuilt the military. I was proud to do it. But some of the things I hated to do, I hated certain of the weapons because the level of power is so enormous. It's so dangerous, so bad. But we have to do what we have to do. We make the best weapons in the world, and we've got a lot of them. And we've given a lot to Israel, frankly.
Hold on. This is not the video. This is the video. I'll have to play it from Twitter. Here we are.
This took 3,000 years to get to this point. Can you believe it? And it's going to hold up, too. It's going to hold up.
3,000 years. See, there was me. I thought Israel was established in 1948. Where's he getting 3,000 years from? Anyone want to explain that one to me? But anyway, let's carry on.
Okay, thank you. You can use my hand. Okay. Use my hand.
Here it is. I've got a feeling they've piped in the music. I don't think the music was playing there. I think the channel has done it. Now, as I was driving in today, I happened to catch a little bit of Nick Tell It To Your Straight Ferrari on LBC, and he had this guest on who was a professor of physiology. Basically, a professional body language ghost type, right? Probably the gayest segment I've ever heard in my entire life, because this professor was incredibly camp man, an incredibly camp individual. And he was excitedly kind of fawning over little kind of gestures between the leaders, which struck me as just incredibly feminine. But lo and behold, basically everybody is doing this. This is like mainstream media, the sloppiness, and so on and so forth. They're all doing it. Anyway, let's watch a few more of these videos.
Where's United Kingdom? Where's our friend?
Well, hold on. Let's save Starmer. Let's save Starmer a minute, because he's like the main event. Let's watch Macron first of all. This kind of body language ghost professor really analyzed this very deeply. And he said, like, his analysis that I picked up this morning was that if you watch this carefully, I'll play it from the beginning again, right? That Macron, because Trump has consistently done this ever since 2016, whenever these two have met, Trump has done this kind of man wrestling thing. So Macron here came with his game face on, and he came prepared. And even though Macron had come prepared, Trump still at the end sneaks in a win. So let's try to watch this play out, because I was only listening to this this morning. So let's have a watch. Right, there's Macron fighting fit. Right, he's like, I'm ready for you, Don. I know that you're coming. You're not going to have me this time. Wait, let's have a watch. Right, he puts the hand on top. This is incredibly important, according to body language professor. So let's carry on. Right, Macron technically on points is 1-0 up here against the Don. Now, this is the sneak. He got a little tap at the end. Watch. Little tap at the end. And people have been showing Macron's hand in the aftermath of that. I don't know if that's real or not. Another thing that got people's attention was the meeting of Erdogan and Meloni, where we see a little bit of bants between one of the wily masters of the game, Erdogan, and Zionist stooge Maloney. Let's have a little watch.
Now from the plane.
We
arrived together.
Everything okay?
İyi gördüm.
Oh, you look great.
Oh, thank you.
Ama
very kind.
Sigarayı bıraktırmam lazım.
But I have to make you stop smoking something.
I know. I don't want
this
to feel so bad.
This is impossible.
Yeah.
Just a bit of bants. You've got to make those sort of kind of comments. They're trying to like build rapport up between themselves. Then the clip that people have really, really been talking about, and which is, I would say, taken up the lion's share of the attention online, in the press. Like, I think this is what Zionists, like the Hasbro network, I noticed Talk TV had gone big on this angle. Like, everybody's wild for this moment here, which does kind of make Starmer look like a chump. But let's have a little watch of it.
Where's the United Kingdom? Where's our friend? Where? Come here. Is everything going good?
Very good.
That's
very good.
Very nice of you here. These people all came in like 20 minute notice.
What the fuck? Let's watch it again. Come on.
Where's the United Kingdom? Where's our friend? Where? Come here.
I think he goes to lean into, he goes to lean into the mic and somehow, like, I don't know, he got like the wrong seat. It's just the way he looks.
Is everything going good?
Very good.
That's
very good.
Very nice of you here. These people all came in like 20.
It is funny, to be fair, it is funny. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Let's watch it one more time, because it's just...
Where's the United Kingdom? Where's our friend? Where? Come here. Is everything going good?
Very good.
That's very nice of you here. These people all came in like 20-minute notice, and I think it's fantastic. And we have so many others, and just so many others. And
So there was that. Now, see, the thing is that the narrative they want you to believe here is that the British had nothing to do with this, and that this is a humiliating moment from Starmer, showing Britain to be irrelevant in the world. The truth is a little bit more complicated, as we'll get to in a moment. But let us first have a look at the meeting of Carney and Trump, and then we're going to get to the big story, of course, which is the involvement of well, you know who. Let's watch the Carney bit first.
I'm glad you upgraded me to president.
Oh,
yeah.
Great stuff.
It's good.
I started. I'll tell you what, Starmer's just... That guy on LBC this morning was saying that the trouble with Starmer is that everything he does is extremely submissive and supine. Right? They're like, they're pursuing this strategy of sucking up to Trump, but Starmer is doing it in such a way. I mean, even here, look at his body. It is really, truly. Look at that fate. Look at that. What a gimp. I mean, he is coming across like a massive gimp, which is unfortunate. But it is hiding a deeper and darker truth, which is that all of this, everything that you're seeing here. Well, let's take a little watch of this video first here. So there's no sound on this, but there we see the Dark Lord himself was in the building. He was there, which prompted a lot of people to ask, what the hell is Tony Blair doing there, given that he's not actually a world leader? Little do they know, friends. So let's watch this fascinating encounter between the Dark Lord and the God Emperor here. Emperor meets Emperor. Let's have a little watch. I mean, bloody hell. Jesus. don't know what you call that. So a lot of people were like, his smile was something else here. I couldn't help myself but screen grab this moment. I mean, what do you call that? What do you call? Do you ever read Batman in the comics? It reminded me a lot of the Joker in the Killing Joke, the side profile of the Joker, really quite sinister. But there's more, because I mean, one thing that happened is that the impertinent Big Beth Rigby of Sky News fame decided that she would try to actually, like, she deigned to question the Dark Lord. Here is how she got on with her attempt to interview Blair.
Beth Rigby, Sky News, Mr. Blair. So what do you say to those who think you shouldn't sit on the board, sir?
How dare she approach unsolicited the Dark Lord and think that she'd actually get an audience? Come on now. Let's watch it again.
Beth Rigby, Sky News, Mr. Blair. So what do you say to those who think you shouldn't sit on the board, sir?
Now, the reality is here is that there was this bit going around that I saw from the news agents, Emily Maitlis and friends. And I actually think Maitlis has the correct story here of what made it all happen. Let's have a little listen to Maitlis.
I had this sort of spidey scent. It was like a bat signal went up and I suddenly went, I've just realised something that was staring us in the face.
And this is a woman who has looked into the eyes of his darkness, if you remember, in that interview. So let's have a little listen.
While we were talking, and the person who would talk in ideas of 20-point plans is not, frankly, Donald Trump. Donald Trump gets the credit here for having the power and the muscle to kind of kick people into action. You know, nothing will take that away. But if there's one person that you associate more than anyone else with a 12-point peace plan, and that means detail, and that means an arc, and that means a sense of where it ends up, not just where it starts, it sounded to me like Tony Blair. And we had this chat over the weekend, and I was like, I think we should just put out...
Maitlis is breaking the kayfabe here, because what you're meant to do is... Ooh, Trump humiliated Starmer, blah, blah, blah. But this is actually true, what Maitlis is saying right here. It's as far as I can tell, confirmed by all sources that this was Blair's plan. Not only was it Blair's plan with Trump, this was Blair's plan first pitched to Antony Blinken over a year ago. In fact, they were originally talking about it with Kushner, even back in Trump 1.0. Then Blair took it to Blinken, and now they ditched the Riviera plan and got in this plan instead. So somehow, it doesn't matter if it's Blinken or Trump, that's the plan that they end up going with. It's funny how that happens.
The feelers a bit and see if that feels right. Now, some of my sources in the Israeli government administration, have pointed me to Dormer, who is the, you know, part of the Netanyahu government who's in charge of the hostage release. But they did not deny that Blair had a very, very pivotal plan. I mean, I would go so far as saying broadly architect of.
And then today we wake up to a tweet from Steve Witkoff, not quite saying that, but not far off, saying... I would like to acknowledge the vital role of the United Kingdom in assisting and coordinating efforts that have led us to this historic day in Israel. In particular, I want to recognise the incredible input and tireless efforts of the National Security Advisor, Jonathan Powell. Who was Jonathan Powell? Jonathan Powell, before he was the National Security Advisor many years ago, was Tony Blair's right-hand man in securing the Good Friday Agreement in Easter 1998.
Well, so he knows what a peace deal looks like. And he knows the thing that you have heard over the years from those involved in the Good Friday Agreement is that you cannot make a good deal by getting more than the other person. If you think you have come away with something that looks too good to be true, it is too good to be true. And all that means is that it won't hold. In other words, if you just leave at this point in the Trump conversation, in the Netanyahu conversation, which is, we got the hostages back, we're done here, you are not done. Exactly. And you are setting yourself up for failure. So I was talking to somebody very close to the Starmer government, who said they didn't want to give sort of too much away. They said it wasn't really their lane. But this person used the phrase, I heard his toniness has been heavily...
Incredible. Incredible.
...heavily involved, in brackets, pissing off civil servants in the process.
The news agents.
So there we go. This was one that was done above the level of government. It was done on the level of direct quote, his toniness. How incredible. Well, I am hopeful that Blair is not cut out of the deal. If he is cut out of the deal, it won't hold. If he stays there and is able to set up shop in Israel or in Gaza, it will hold. And it's actually a neat little victory for the Globos against the Zios. Even though they're putting a brave face on it for Netanyahu and so on, they're putting a brave face on it for the Israelis. Basically, this is still a massive L for Netanyahu. I mean, let's think about what he did here. He basically went on a 2 to 3 year rage lust, berserker rage mode, and got sweet FA for it. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. So anyway, let's see what happens with that. That's my instant reaction. A lot can still happen. The Israelis aren't trustworthy. But if Tony's on the ground, I think they're not going to invade the Blair-run neutral administration. They wouldn't dare. They wouldn't dare if he's there. So that is good. And also, if he's preoccupied over there, it could be good for us here. Because when Tony's away, the cats will play, as we've seen. So it could actually be a good thing for the rest of us, because he's busy over there. Although that's not stopped him before, of course. It's not stopped him before. Just before we hit super chats and super thanks, I saw something today that it was a piece that somebody sent me from Stuart Lee. And I want to watch it in full, because as I was watching this, I was thinking, if I could spend my entire life confined to the 3 minutes of this clip, all the things that you see in this clip, including the Stuart Lee part, if I could just live there forever, I would be happy. I know this is a utopian dream, but it kind of struck me as a really interesting little piece. I'll play it, and then when we finish here, I will get on to super thanks and super chats. Let's have a little watch of this together.
The depictions of teenagers in television today, they're kind of selfish, avaricious, out for themselves. They're also kind of confident and sassy and cool, and they're really, really at home with sex and drugs. If you look at portrayals of teenagers in the 70s in, say, something like Children of the Stones or The Changes, they're really terrified of the world, and they're uncomfortable and alienated and alone. And I think that is much truer to what it's really like to be a teenager than the way you see them in Skins. Children of the Stones is set in a village with a prehistoric stone circle about it in the mid-70s, 1976, where an astrophysicist has to go and do some research there with his son, Matt. And they gradually uncover this conspiracy where everyone in the village is being taken over by a kind of mind ray, which is connected to a black hole in space. Henrik in Children of the Stones is an astronomer gone bad, who's using his power for evil. And he realises pretty quickly on that Matt is his intellectual equal and the force that he has to vanquish to hold control of the village.
This is me against Blair, I reckon.
Very perceptive, that son of yours. Perceptive and formidable.
Changes begins with images of buildings falling down, stuff exploding and hills collapsing over this weird kind of mid-70s German progressive rock soundtrack. It's about a sudden fit of madness that overtakes Britain where all the adults decide that all machines and technology have to be smashed.
There's Morgoth smashing up his tech.
And then they flee. And Nikki, the teenage girl, gets left behind by her parents and has to try and look out for herself in this world where all values have been overturned.
You shouldn't be here. Everybody's gone from here. Either gone or died.
Died?
Skins opens with loads of shots of funky young people, proceeds to depict their vile, selfish, misogynist lives with kind of horrible, hip, sassy language. And there's just a degree of cynicism in the characters and in the way that the programme is put together.
For Christ's sake, Tony!
The opening 5 minutes of Skins is just this pointless invective of between the Harry Enfield father and the horrible little rat-faced son. And I just really want, the Harry Enfield dad to just get that kid and punch his face in.
So amazing. I love this. This clip is so good.
So here's something that's happened in 30 years. Look how the kids in Skins greet each other, right? Like fondling each other's genitals under a table. This is how children should greet each other, like in Children of the Stones.
Hello.
Hello.
Can we have a ride?
Where to?
Oh, just round the village. Show you the sights.
It's interesting looking at the different challenges that face the children in these programmes. In The Changes, for example, Nikki has to find her way alone through a Britain that is in a kind of apocalyptic meltdown. And in Skins, Sid has to go and try and get some dope from a dope dealer in a brothel so that he can get a girl so catastrophically spliffed up that she'll have sex with him without realising who he is. I'm really glad I'm not a teenager watching TV for teenagers now, because I would feel really left out by something like Skins. But there's something really comforting for, like, nerds and weirdos about things like Children of the Stones and The Changes, things that make you feel less alone. And that's a really great thing that art can do. Whereas I think something like Skins would make me, as a teenager, feel more alone.
Almost reactionary from Stuart Lee there. I really enjoyed that. So I wanted to share it with everybody. I relate to it. So in terms of super thanks from last week's video, feels like a lifetime ago. Right, can anybody guess without, don't look it up. What were we talking about last week? Nobody look it up. I want to see how long it takes for somebody, for one person, to tell me what we were talking about last week. Compost, yeah. What was the actual story? It wasn't even LBC. It was talks, right. What was the story? It wasn't Farage. What was the story? Everybody's forgotten already what the story was. What was the story? What was the story? You're all wrong. You're all wrong. None of it. Yes, we watched Jeremy Kyle, but what was the story? See, there's a point to this. There's a point. What was the story? Okay, we're almost a minute in. Nobody's got it. Nobody's got it. Fucking hell. Not a single... Yes! Woo! Darkamon at almost the 2 minute mark has got it. The story last week was Gary Neville. Last week's stop story was Gary Neville, and you've already forgotten in the space of a week. In the space of a week, you've forgotten Gary Neville blaming white men for the synagogue attack. Do you remember? No, that was too long ago. It was last week. All right, let's carry on. Okay, so on that video from last week, featuring Gary Neville, Inquisition Rack says, as a news ignorer, I'm really enjoying the weekly slop overview. Oh, well, thanks a lot, Inquisition Rack. Not enough to know that it was Gary Neville this week, though, eh? He says, a handy summary that helps contextualise the slopinions I hear from my friends, family and colleagues. Kyle will make a great Reform MP in the mould of MAGA Slop Lord. He understands the mind of the slopulation from his decades face of face with them. Proper horror show on last week's Deepest Law, which was called More on Mao Zedong's Crazy Wife, says, I've had some good compost in my time. I love a good Savoy, mulched Savoy cabbage and mushrooms, shredded mushrooms and caramelized onions on a compost pile. That is hot stuff. You can get that at a number of different places. Speaking of compost, proper horror show, I got something to show you. You'll like this. So this is going to make you warm and fuzzy inside, or at least it did to me this morning. Take a look at this, right? Take a look at this. Look at that. I'm in the green. Now, it's still got 20 degrees to get up to 60, but I'm in the green, ladies and gentlemen. I'm in the green. What happened? How did I figure out that I needed what I needed to do? I opened it up and the temperature had plummeted. And what I found inside the hot bin yesterday was mushrooms, ladies and gentlemen. Fungus, white fungus was growing. Now, fungus can be a sign that the decomposition process has started, but it is also a sign that the bin's temperature has dropped too low, because fungus likes to live more around 25, 30 degrees or lower. It doesn't really like it up at the 40s and 50s, okay? So I read up on what does it mean? The problem was the green to brown ratio was off. There were not enough browns. So I needed to import more browns. And I did that by taking the special observer edition of the Blair Gaza one with Blair on the front. Do you remember I bought it for that video? And I shredded about half of that in my paper shredder. So a huge wad of newspaper. And then I got about half of that in bulking agent, which is shredded wood that you get from the hot bin company in a big bag. I put a bunch of shredded wood. I put that paper in. I gave it all a big mix up. I re-kick-started the bottle. And lo and behold, today, it's up to 40. Next challenge is getting it up to 60. I'm going to start adding greens again. And you see, the basic idea is that the greens, which are nitrogen rich, give off the necessary kind of heat, right? But the browns act as the fuel. Okay, the nitrogen rich, the greens create the energy, but the browns are the fuel. And what was going wrong with my bin is that the greens didn't have stuff to burn. They didn't have enough browns to burn. Okay, and that's a bit of a hot bin composting science for you. Okay, so let's carry on. A noble Englishman on The Dark Truth about Spielberg's movies revealed. Oh, yes, a classic from earlier in the year. I never did get round to making that Robin Williams video, did I? Hate it when a good idea goes unrealised, but grayed out now. Somebody needs to make a meme of all of my grayed out ideas. What would be in the graveyard of unrealized projects? 100 Mario facts, 100 Mario lore facts with no theory. That video never got made. The Robin Williams video never got made. What are some of the others that never got made? Oh, it's such a shame. It makes me weep. He says, hi, AA. I have always enjoyed your content and you have a major influence on my political journey. Well, thanks a lot, sir. Much appreciated. He says, I, like yourself, was an avid hip-hop fan growing up and also used to watch those classic stoner movies such as Friday, How High, and Don't Be a Menace. Now, I have to be honest, I never watched those movies, but my brother did. My brother had all the How High movies. And what was that one with Method Man in it? What was that one involving Method Man? Was it Keenan and Cal? Keenan and, I don't know, there were these two black guys, and yeah, I mean, he was really into that stuff. That was a scene I was never into myself, as the more kind of straight laced of the pair of us. I mean, my brother is a much more wild character than me. I'm kind of very boring straight laced character, as you know. But anyway, he says, I'm sure you know the films I'm talking about. Recently, I decided to revisit these movies, and I could not believe just how anti-white they are. Oh, interesting. The idea that black culture is cool and hip, and white culture and people is weird and boring. I would love to see a Deepest Lore discussing the subversiveness and just outright anti-white, how anti-white these movies are, and how they've created a generation which idolizes black culture, creating the urban youth in white areas. Looking back, even based comedies such as Dave Chappelle, I've got an old video, by the way, explaining why Dave Chappelle is containment. If you back in the misty archives, if you search for Chappelle, you'll find that video. And Cat Williams always dip their toe into white people, am I right, culture. I feel that Morgoth would be an excellent guest for this discussion, and maybe even Devon Stack. Keep up the good fight. Yeah, that's interesting. Now, as an aficionado of hip-hop culture, the anti-white thing in their culture, I think, is kind of baked in. Kind of like, I always experienced it from the, like, as almost as a kind of David Attenborough watching the Gorillas or something. I experienced it from the outside. I knew I was not a part of that culture. And so you kind of accept its internal logic. And yeah, absolutely, you're right that it's deeply ingrained in their way of thinking and being. And it also comes wedded to this idea that the entire system, it's not just white people per se, but the entire system is rigged against them in their thinking, right? And it leads to almost like a conspiratorial logic as well, where it's baked, it's definitely baked in. I would agree with you. This can't be a real name. This can't be a real name. Parikshit Patel. That's not a real name. Parikshit, that's not. I'm just going to call you Mr. Patel, okay? Mr. Patel says, hello, sir. Thank you for this very wonderful video. Much enjoying you and your beautiful guests commenting. Okay, thanks a lot, Mr. Patel. Thank you. Chris Factory. Ridiculous. Chris Factory Boy says, Farrow & Ball is poor quality paint, despite decent colours. You should get their colours mixed in Dulux Trade instead. Oh, don't talk to me about paint and tiles and fucking wall colours. Just don't talk to me about it. Benjamin Houghton says, thanks. That was on Why Rich People Want Democracy. Or the thumbnail title is Why Merchants Prefer Liberal Democracy. I recommend that one from the archives. A classic AA video. James Goodwin says, I spent the weekend working through your Foundations of Writing course. Oh, well, I'm glad that you're doing the course, sir. Buy it now. Promo code Shredder, 25% off. Many, many, many people have done that course now, and it's made them all better writers. Overall, it's been excellent and well worth the price. Well, thank you, James. I'm still a couple of lectures away from the end. One thing you don't seem to cover is paragraphs, the proper use of which has always been a little unclear to me. Have you got any tips on how best to use them, how long they should be, etc.? Well, I can't remember if this made it onto the course in one of those lectures that you haven't watched yet, but I always remember that the correct grammatical explanation for a paragraph is that it has to be a concise idea, one unit of idea, like one concept, one idea, right? And my supervisor was an absolute stickler. In fact, foundations of writing wouldn't even exist had he not been such a psychopath on grammar, on parts of speech, on writing style, and so on. And as I've mentioned before, he used to write, like, you know, he'd just write comments in the margin where he'd underline like a particularly pretentious phrase or something, and he'd just write in the margin "twat" and things like just be like, you know, or he'd be like, "Nima, think first before you slap down these half-baked sentences," and things like this. It was a real like kick in the nuts, because I was used to being like a top level student, you know, distinction without even trying, and you know, top grades for 80 years, and you know, all that kind of stuff. But it was like such a like blow to my ego to have this guy, like every single thing I would write would just come back literally covered, like every single thing, to the point where I had to learn how to write again from the ground up, okay? Because he just shred it to pieces. But anyway, paragraphs were one of those things where I would always write very long paragraphs. Even now, I'll turn in pieces to editors when I'm, you know, writing for magazines and things, and have quite long paragraphs where, and the editor will typically then break them up afterwards. But I remember one time I wrote a paragraph where, well, he'd written in the margin, "Nima, this paragraph is 3 pages long." And usually I just kind of took all his comments lying down. But on this occasion, I wrote back to him and I said, "Look, on like page 17 here, you've noted that the paragraph is 3 pages long." And I said, "Look, it says here that a paragraph is a discrete unit of thought." And I said, "This 3-page sequence was a discrete unit of thought." And he wrote back and he said, "Nima, don't be a smart ass." So ever since then, basically, if you feel like you've been going on for a while, start a new paragraph. Honestly, I still don't understand it myself. Start a new paragraph once in a while. I don't have good insight into the logic of the paragraph, I'm afraid. Zach Fake Name 66 says, "Dear AA, I have nothing specific on this video I want to talk about. This is on last week's office hours. But I want to thank you instead." Oh, thank you very much, Zach. "Thanks in general for the information that you've presented over the years." Oh, well, bit of gratitude. Thank you very much, sir. Well, I'm grateful to you for following me for all these years. He says, "I also admire the analytic lens through which you see the world. I read some Evola, Spengler, and Carlyle over the past year. One day I'll take your writing course, since I believe writing is a powerful tool. This thanks is long overdue. That's all for now." Well, Zach, thank you very much, sir. Felt it in my heart. And yeah, you're right. Clear writing, I think, goes a long way. And one of the things I've been pleased about is the take-up of some of the stuff I've written, because I believe a lot of the NRX stuff was written in very convoluted or difficult to understand sentences, whether it was the Yarvinese or Nick Land, both of whom I find impenetrable writers. So I wanted to kind of, in a way, provide an antidote to that with absolutely crystal clear guide to elite theory and things like that. So I do think there's a power in being clear. Not everybody agrees. There are other people who believe in obfuscation, right? But I've always believed that you must lay it out as clearly as possible. As clearly as possible. Okay, speaking of which, now we're getting to yesterday's video, part one of my series, Nima Parvini versus Right-Wing Ideas, which promises to be a little bit controversial, to say the least. Last I checked, there were 700 and odd comments on that. Almost all of them unhappy comments. But unfortunately, in those 760 odd replies, very few of them actually tried to provide an answer to the specific problem that I was trying to grapple with. I think a lot of people took the argument as a justification for mass immigration. It was not a video about mass immigration or justifying mass immigration. The clue was at the start when I specifically said I am against immigration or mass immigration, and I think that they, you know, they should close the border. And would, you know, I'm one of those who would like to see remigration if possible. Right? It wasn't about that. It was about a much more specific and narrow problem when it comes to how you should promote, how you should select. Right? And this is a disagreement I had with Pharaoh back in the day on Cigar Stream when we talked about meritocracy. It's a disagreement I had with Mike from Imperium Press. And it's a disagreement I have with a lot of right-wingers on what should the selection criteria be for how to pick the right people for each role. And the argument is that it should be, you know, should be you should use nepotism or you should use ethnic in-group preference. And my very simple question is, what happens if you lose, what happens if you would adopt that strategy and it doesn't actually get you ahead? It doesn't actually win out against those other firms or other football clubs, whatever the unit, nations that don't select in that way. Okay, I think I laid it out pretty clearly, to be honest, but a lot of people, for some reason, took it as something quite different from that, judging by a lot of the comments. But, you know, this is what it is. You can't expect, I mean, you have a look at your average IQ distribution. You cannot expect everybody to grasp everything first time around. I'm explaining it again. I mean, maybe Mike or Farrell, one of these people, will have a proper stab coming up with a real answer to the issue. Because, I mean, I guess the, and I went a little bit back and forth with Morgoth on it as well, on Twitter. The real issue, right, remember, we have to treat the world as it is, not as it ought to be. The real issue is, if your method leads to line go down, or if it leads to suboptimal results, if it leads to results that don't quote unquote win, whatever win means, then you're going to have a very difficult time convincing people, and especially convincing governments and elites and so on, that this is the way to go. And that being the case, whether it's a football club or a hedge fund or a national government or even an international government, it's going to be very difficult to convince them to go with your route, which cuts out large chunks of talent pool, when what they're looking to do is min-max. Okay, this is a very simple kind of, and again, it's value-free. It's not what, it's not the world I want to see. Let's not forget, never the world I want to see. It's the world that is. It's not what I would choose, but this is the situation. And I still, I have to be honest, in 700-800 answers, didn't actually really see a serious comeback on the point, on the actual point I was raising. There was a couple of, I'm not going to say all of the replies were bad. There were a couple of good points raised. Morgoth raised a couple of good points as well. I still think the answer to it is not strong enough. If I'm honest, it's not stronger than the argument that comes from the other side. Not a justification for mass immigration, by the way. Mass immigration has been shown to fail. And the Keir Starmer, the British Prime Minister, admitted that it's a failed experiment. Pretty much everybody admits that that hasn't worked. But that's not what I was talking about in this video. But anyway, there have been a number of super thanks on this video. So let's see if some of these provide good answers. Let's have a look. Adam says, if the UK government banned all football clubs from bringing in foreign talent, would those clubs not be incentivized to invest in local youth clubs to develop talent domestically? In the absence of foreigners, and with this added youth investment, the dream of becoming a pro footballer becomes more attainable for UK youth, creating a new culture of excellence. At that point, these clubs would no longer be parasitic corporations profiting off UK citizens' football addictions. They would be providing a national service. Was this not the same exception the Nationalist Socialists put on the corporations that existed under their regime? Well, if the point of the Football League was to maximise the performance of the England football team, you would be right. And I mentioned Jimmy Hill, who, as I remember growing up, was making all of these arguments every single week on Jimmy Hill's, was it called Football Chat, Breakfast Club, Jimmy Hill? What was that show called, guys? Jimmy Hill's Football Club, Jimmy Hill's, what was it called? Anybody watch that show? Jimmy Hill's, what was that bloody show? It was like Jimmy Hill and a bunch of journalists sitting around a table with like massive croissants, and he had like croissants and breakfast and orange juice and stuff, and they'd sit around talking about the football matters of the day. I can't remember what it was called, but I used to watch it every week. And Jimmy Hill, week in, week out, would say, look, the Premier League is all Sunday supplement. That was it, Sunday supplement. It was called Jimmy Hill's Sunday supplement. And up until the very day he died, right, Jimmy Hill would be on there saying, it's all well and good, all this money coming into the Premiership. It's all well and good bringing in these expensive foreign talents, but you're denying English players spaces in top level football, and the England football team's going to suffer, right, because of a lack of first team opportunities. So we need to restrict foreign players. We need to stop all of this. Okay, Jimmy Hill would say it week in, week out. Unfortunately, and this is again not the world I want to see, the world that actually happened. Okay. Every football club, once they started bringing in the foreign players, once those rules were relaxed, in fact, some of Jimmy Hill's own activism brought in the Bosman rule, as I remember, and, you know, they made it easier for mobility of players, right? Once they started bringing in the Cantonas and, you know, Fabrizio Ravanelli and Vialli and Ruud Gullit and all of this, I remember it. Once that ball had started rolling, and you had Arsene Wenger with his modern methods in football, it was only a matter of time. Right now, Arsenal are doing it. Now Manchester United have to do it. Now Newcastle have to do it. Now all the football clubs have to do it. And before you know it, even like your kind of Division One side has got like some random Norwegian centre-back, and you know they've got like a Finnish right back and a Romanian left back and some African dude playing in the middle, and you know, once that had become the game, it was a runaway train. So you're right, Jimmy Hill was right, but once you open the door, the game became that. And what I was trying to isolate is the logic of it. Once that's the game. And it has become the game, just like international markets have created a different game at the level of international finance. Once that's the game then becomes your pool of talent has to be the whole world. And if you don't do that, you're going to go down the league. That's the very narrow point I was trying to make here. So I agree with you from a kind of England football team a perspective, or like a national pride perspective or whatever, it would be good. But ultimately, Jimmy Hill's answer was suboptimal for Arsenal and Manchester United and Chelsea and Man City. You know, now we're at like fast forward 20, 25 years, and every football club is the plaything of some massive rich sheikh or something. You know, every football club's got a mega billionaire Arab donor or something like this. You know, after Abramovich, now they're even richer because that is the game now. Again, it's not what I want to see, but these things have a life of their own. So Manchester United or Manchester City have become unmoored from actual Manchester or the people of Manchester. They're now these international entities. But they exist, and they have their own logic, and they have their own... They want to win. They just want to win all the time. Right? Psychopathically, they want to win. A corporation just wants to win all the time. The hedge fund wants to win. The nation state, no matter what, wants to win. Now, you can say, well, what's the point of that? And honestly, there is no point. There is no point to it. This is the overriding sense I got when reading John Mearsheimer's The Tragedy of Great Powers. At a certain point, it's like, well, who's this for? Winning for what? Like, for what possible fucking purpose? But this is the thing. Like, these things with mass and scale take on a momentum and a life of their own. And this is the world that exists now. And what I'm saying is the argument, the kind of nationalist argument, is basically like, well, we have to break up the entire structure of the entire world as it exists today. It's going to be very difficult to do that as long as all of these entities exist. And remember, realism. How are you going to stop it once the train has already run away? And this is going to be a lot of the themes. I recorded a video earlier on technology or on technophobia. And, you know, technology is it's a very similar case where, well, the thing is, the genie is already out of the bottle. Can you put it back in? Spengler said you can't. Spengler said you can never put it, like, once it's gone, you can't ever get it back. There's no going back. Optimism is cowardice. So, yeah, these are difficult issues, right? But this is the whole point of doing this series. Salad Fork says, we have to accept there is no utopia. All political solutions are imperfect. As regards ethnic gatekeeping of our elites, it comes down to deliberately rejecting competent foreigners, which, as you say, may result in us being dominated by foreigners in the long run, or allowing foreigners to enter our elite class, which will result in us being dominated by foreigners, if perhaps to a lesser degree. For myself, I prefer my leaders to have interests as closely aligned to my own as possible. I acknowledge that this may result in the next Genghis Khan rising somewhere else and conquering my own people rather than rising in my country. I respect the attempt to get people to objectively interrogate their own beliefs, and I'm interested to see the results. Well, thank you very much, Salad Fork. Well, yeah, that's good. That's good. But what I'm trying to show here is that you're basically arguing we need not to min-max, right? That the suboptimal solution, right, which may actually lead in long-term disaster, is the way to go because the min-max solution that we currently have is already leading to disaster. Something like this, right? I accept that as an answer, but at least you're kind of getting towards like some sort of honesty here, right? Maybe the answer is the min maxes are right from the autistic point of view of the stats, but it's actually preferable to take the lower stats because the costs associated with it are even higher. Something like this. This is absolutely fine as an answer, I would say. Whether it will be persuasive to enough people or enough elites remains to be seen. Australian man says, Kostin Alamaru, that is Bronze Age pervert, goes over the subject of foreign groups making up aristocracies in his book, Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy. It might be worth having him on to discuss. Well, that is if he would come on. I'd be happy to talk to old Kostin Alamaru. Right, I'd be willing to talk to him about this. Although I will say, knowing what we know about him now, I do wonder what game he was playing with this. Every ruling class is an ethnic ruling class and often is foreign. I mean, the classic example would be the Normans ruling over the native Brits following the William the Bastard or William the Conqueror coming in. Legitimate, but one has to wonder what his current reason is for pushing this line. Like, is there an elite group hobbits and elves, let's say, is there a group of elves that he aligns himself with? That's a question to ask him, I suppose. Tom says, and if he came on, I would ask him that directly as well, see if he has an answer to it. Tom says, and this is on the same video on ethno-narcissism, the argument against this is that Abisaya matters. It matters in the battle of group selection. In the war of quality of the mass is just important as the elite. Abisaya matters among the elite as well. So to get the best of both worlds, you run a eugenics program to differentially select for alleles of genes associated with higher trait values that you desire. You do these differential fertility via differential fertility. People with desirable traits have relatively more children than undesirable. It keeps in-group loyalty and, for example, even in consanguineous gene pools, it can clear out serious deleterious mutations caused by IBD. But, yeah, you're right. For normal case, ethnic narcissism plus eugenics would theoretically be most optimal because it is the best of both worlds, kinship bonds and increasingly good stock. That is, if eugenics actually works, and disregarding moral questions, assume just embryo selection and not crazy stuff, says Tom. Well, the thing is, and today's video, which is is on the even spicier and even more tricky topic of racial superiority, where I am once again arguing against a lot of the ideas that we see from what passes as the right today. You've got to remember, Abisaya, okay, doesn't just like magically grow on trees. It is inculcated, and it comes from struggle. It comes from living in a harsh environment where you have to struggle to survive. You're living in the desert or in the mountain, coming. You're a rough, like a rough existence, a savage, if you want to put it that way, coming out, bursting forth against the civilized, decadent, superior society. That is what Abisaya has manifested as typically in history. So it's important to understand what Abisaya is. And whether, you know, that is not, it's not simply in-group preference. It is a fanatical group of warriors bursting forth from the fringes. And done properly, it should be borderline terrifying to bourgeois sensibilities. Abisaya, properly thought of, is anti-civilizational. It strips down, it burns down libraries. So the only people I see producing those sorts of characters in the current setup are people who are set up as the enemies of the West, basically. You know, it's your kind of goat herding Yemeni, what do they call those guys? The Yemeni, the Houthi rebels, right? It's your Taliban. Like, this is your Abisaya. So that's a very, what I'm saying is, that's a very difficult thing to embody if you've grown up, right? If you've grown up watching anime cartoons and whacking off to trans porn. Or let's make it more benign. If you've just grown up, you know, watching normal television and Friends on TV and shit like this, eating at Burger King, that's it. Like, you can't just grow Abisaya magically. It has to come from genuine struggle, hardship, real suffering. Anyway, I think that's enough of that. Let us have a look now at some super chats. And Coney current year says, since you're going through a bit of a left-wing phase, I've come across two new lefty eco books that may be interesting to you. One is called Goliath's Curse, The History and Future of Societal Collapse. Does sound interesting. The other is called Against the Machine, On the Unmaking of Humanity by Paul Kingsnorth. Okay, well, I'll note those down, Coney. I'll note those down. I've got quite a few books I want to cover after this current series. Let me just name some of the, if people want to get ahead and, you know, do like the reading of what I'm currently interested in. The last book I bought, I haven't read it yet, is called Escape from Rome, The Failure of Empire and the Road to Prosperity by Walter Schiedel. So that's one book. Another book I bought recently is by Peter Oborn called The Fate of Abraham, Why the West is Wrong About Islam. I'm just fascinated to know like what he has to say, because I was surprised to see him writing that, because he wrote a book ages ago called The Rise of Political Lying, which I remember. And then later he turned into a bit of a TDS kind of anti-Trump guy and wrote a book called The Assault on Truth, Boris Johnson, Donald Trump, and the Emergence of a new moral barbarism, right? But then he's written this kind of apologetics for Islam. I just would love to know what he has to say in that book. Another book I got recently was by Michael Hudson called The Destiny of Civilization, Finance Capitalism, Industrial Capitalism, or Socialism. I'm interested in that. I bought a bunch of books by David Graeber, including Debt, The First 5,000 Years, The Utopia of Rules, and various others. That came from Adam Curtis and Simon Roberts. He's one of the sources for the current Adam Curtis documentary that we're watching. I got The Pillars of Wisdom by the great GLO, which is a mental book, to be honest, absolutely mental. A bunch of books by, Caleb Maupin. I've got this Economic History of England, which Simon Roberts gave me, which is really fascinating. Patriot Games by Simon Tomlin. Like, these are all books on my to-do list. Jack Ellul's Autopsy of Revolution. And a bunch of books on Stalin as well. Was Stalin really necessary? I want to look at the Stalinist decision-making process. I haven't had a chance to make the video yet, but one of the issues in the Soviet Union is that Stalin started to act as a bottleneck in the decision-making process, because all of the underlings, all of the rest of the Politburo, wouldn't make decisions. They wouldn't make a call, and so Stalin was down to they want to change the sign in Moscow Square. Should it be yellow or should it be red? All right, and Stalin would have to sign off on this. And there are times where he gets really pissed off. He's like, fucking hell, just make the call. You know, I don't care if it's red or blue. Just fuck off and do it yourself. And the trouble is that sometimes they would make the call, and then inevitably on those times where they would make the call, Stalin would come in and say, well, what, you're an idiot. It has to be red. It's the Soviet Union, for God's sake. Right? So heads you lose, tails you lose with Stalin. But because of that, because of his controlling nature in a way, he himself becomes a massive bottleneck in the Soviet bureaucracy itself. So this is an interesting issue for decision making, because a lot of people on the right favor models like monarchy, or they favor Yavin talks about dictatorships and so on. But this is still an issue, with mass and scale. How do you delegate? How do you delegate it? And how do you entrust people below you to make the right decisions? So, and this was the issue that Stalin basically had a trouble trusting the judgment of others. I think it's an interesting kind of problem. Anyway, Pa says the Achaemenid Empire or the Hittite Empire, which one was more underrated? Well, funnily enough, Pa, in today's video, which I think is going to go live at 6, it's going to debut in a few hours, I talk about the Persian Empire, the first Persian Empire of Cyrus, and draw some lessons from it. I would say that is an underrated empire, the Persian one, more than the Hittite one. The Hittite one is kind of like a little bit off on the side, less central in the kind of development in world history and so on. And as far as I can remember, Spengler and Toynbee and all these kind of great historians don't really know what to do with the Hittites. They kind of keep them on one side. Coney says, I knew there was something suspicious about Anglo-futurism. It feels like a half-hearted attempt to breathe life back into the youth wing of the Tories. Yeah, I mean, I think Anglo-futurism is selling Tom Harwood style, you know, extra runway for Heathrow, you know, with a hint of dissident online politics, you know, just a veneer of online edginess about it, right? But it doesn't really, I can see right through it. Coney says, the US online right was much more interesting when Trump was out of office and when the Dems were in. They were forced to read and be introspective. Now, since the vibe shift, it's become lazy and cringe. So many elements of it carrying water for Zion. Yes, Coney, anybody with half a brain cell could see that. Anybody with an even iota of honesty or, you know, objective observational skills would be able to see that obviously what you're saying is true. Unfortunately, the British right looked at that, and rather than saying, that's a danger, instead they were like, no, I want that for here. I want that for us. That's what they've collectively decided to do. So let me tell you where I am, Dragon's Den's fans. I'm out. I don't want any part of it. I am not becoming part of what they have become over there here. And mark my words, that's what it's going to be when Farage comes in. It'll be that again. I'm not having it. Christian Troy says, I am really loving the centre-left arc, AA. I have gone even further left. I've gone the Dickie Spencer route. Just seeing the absolutely pathetic state of my distant right, I've decided to go more left. Well, it's never really, your transition won't be truly complete, Christian, until, like Spencer, you learn to truly despise the rightoid creature, the conservatard, the conservative. I'm still not quite there. Spencer's almost like a kind of platonic ideal of just internalizing truly how risibly pathetic the kind of conservative is. I've got quite a lot of dislike for the conservative, but I dream of having the levels of disdain that Dickie has. So yeah, more power to you, Christian. Frayn Sustic says, according to some, everything Trump does is 5G chess against Davos and the City of London. How demented is this view? What do you say? Yes, bollocks, Frayn. It's absolute bollocks. Absolute cope and nonsense. This is this Alex Kramer guy, isn't it? It's just crap. None of that is happening. Brian Beletic continues to be the undisputed champion of the world when it comes to reading Trump and his relationship with the European powers. It's all just theatre to sell it to you. Pa says, well, Tony Blair does look a lot like Julius Caesar. Well, yeah, maybe if Caesar was like starting to turn into Skeletor, something like that. Like a kind of Skeletor version of Caesar, maybe. Captain Smith says, Gary Neville does not deserve to be remembered. Yeah, quite right. Let me tell you who does deserve to be remembered, Captain Smith. Manchester United and England right back Paul Parker, whose place was usurped by the pretender Gary Neville, who has been sitting in Paul Parker's shoes, the place that should have been reserved for him. What did Brian Robson say? He tackles like a ferret and leaps like a salmon. Paul Parker, I remember him. Regime Aesthetic says, great video yesterday, AA. The foolish American wasps should have been shown that all elite human capital theory they imported from Eastern Europe, the stats on nepotism, that would have prevented the subversion of our institutions. Merit! Yeah, absolutely, Regime Aesthetics. Absolutely. Again, some of the subtext I don't expect people to pick up on in current year, unfortunately. I was thinking of making Barry Weiss the cover star of that video, but I thought it may have been a little bit too on the nose, so I just made it a picture of narcissists instead. Pillow Man says, Professor Yang from Predictive History kind of answers your question on why meritocracy in his video, Death by Meritocracy. You should consider having him on sometime. You are both solid thinkers. Professor Yang is an interesting character. Speaking of Dickie Spencer, he went on Dickie Spencer's show, which kind of blew my mind. I was like, I've never heard this guy talk to anyone. And they proceeded to have the most mind-bending schizo conversation you could possibly imagine. Like, I was listening to it expecting, like, so, you know, some of his geopolitical takes and so on. Like, literally within 10 minutes, they were on to, like, biblical prophecies and Kabbalah and numerology. And I was like, fucking hell, where's this going? You know, the, you know, secret lodges. And it was mental. It was mental. But he does have some interesting ideas. So maybe I will watch his video, Death by Meritocracy. One thing I will say is that a lot of people were bringing up China and India as examples of countries that don't have this issue. But you have to remember that we're talking about mass and scale. And one thing that China and India have are populations of over a billion people. When you've got a billion people, your talent pool is quite large. It's also worth remembering that neither China nor India are monocultural or monoracial or monoethnic states. There are, in fact, many in India, especially, I think, is still the most multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic country in the entire world. So India is its own empire, if you want to put it that way. Remember, in history, the block of India was different regions, different countries. It was only the Mughals that consolidated it into one place, and then the British that basically turned it into India, right? So the idea that they're just one people, just because they're all brown, is frankly just not true. It is ignorant, I'm afraid. But this is also true of China. Like, the Han have been dominant in China, but you've got to remember a lot of that is myth-making too. Right, a lot of the Chinese Han narrative is myth-making. There are lots of people in China, lots and lots of different groups, lots of different people in China. So it's not strictly speaking true that there are these two massive ethno-states, China and India, and Russia. Russia's not an ethno-state either. They all, in their various ways, have kind of universalist doctrines and methods of selecting, right? The advantage that China and India have got is that they've got just massive, massive labor pools. Whereas in the West, there are declining populations. So what the elites think they're doing is that if you've got a sinking ship, the ship is filling it up with water, right? Their strategy basically is to bring in more men with more buckets to try to get the water out as quickly as possible. More men, more buckets, more men, more buckets. Okay. China and India aren't in that position at the moment because they have very large populations. Now, without wishing to get to Peter's arm on everybody, almost anybody, especially Americans, if you talk to them, talk about the impending demographic collapse of China. This is something else I'm going to talk about, when I talk about the declining birth rate. Okay, I address this specifically, this problem of like demographic decline, because my answer is quite different from the answer that the current elites give and the answers that many rightoids give, okay, which is I simply want the population to decline. But as things stand right now, China and India have an advantage in raw numbers. And when you've got raw numbers, right, just think now, your talent pool is 1.6 billion people. Okay, well, if there were 1.6 billion Europeans, for example, there wouldn't be this issue of having to bring in all the time. Okay, now, I happen to disagree with the elite strategy of bringing in more men with more buckets. They're making things worse. Right, but I'm just, what I'm saying is India and China don't face the same incentives and constraints as the more developed economies in the West, especially economies that are the kind of remnants of empire like Britain or France, or a declining power like the USA. These are all declining powers, so they're facing late empire type problems, whereas China and India are in separate parts of their own cycle. I'll just put it that way. Okay. But anyway, I will check out Professor Zhang. Cringewalker says, does it seem like Blair swooped in and stole Bibi's apprentice? A little bit, but we have to see how it plays out. We have to see how, because Trump's law is still a thing, don't forget, right? But I don't think even Trump would dare try to pull a fast one on the Dark Lord. And in fact, there were all these question marks over whether Blair would actually come in. And I saw a piece from The Independent just last night, I think it was, saying Trump will override any attempt to cut Blair out. That is, Trump will ensure that Blair is on the council. So there you have it. All right. I think that'll do for today. Pick up a course, promo code Shredder. Let me know what you think about the peace settlement or on any of the other issues that we've talked about today. Make sure you catch Nima Parvini versus Right Wing Ideas 2, which is on racial supremacy. I mean, if you thought the first one was controversial, ha, you ain't seen nothing yet. And I'll see you next time. Bye, everyone.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.